Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for being with us today. This is Andrew Olson, host of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. And I'm really excited today to have Aubrey Bergauer, Executive Director of California Symphony Orchestra, with us today. Aubrey, how are you today?
I am good. Thank you for having me.
So excited about this. I think you've got some really interesting take on both engagement and fundraising in the sector and specifically in the arts. So really excited to have you share some of that with us. Before we get into anything too detailed, can you just take a few minutes and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got where you are today?
My mission is to change the narrative for symphony orchestras. And that just probably sounds like this huge, big, audacious, crazy goal. But anybody who knows anything about symphony orchestras knows that there is such a reputation associated with them that the arts, and particularly symphony orchestras, can be stuffy, can be elitist, can be inaccessible. And so this mission for me is to just change all of that and break that down. And that includes everything from making the art form more accessible and talk tons about what that means and looks like, but also has to do with the internal operations and company culture and all these things that I know you care a lot about as well, Andrew. To keep this a short introduction of myself, I will say that, you know, my experience is at organizations of all sizes. California Symphony is a mid-size orchestra. It's a professional orchestra. But before coming here, I spent about a decade in Seattle at the leading institutions, Seattle Symphony in the development department, Seattle Opera in the marketing department, and then at the Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival as the number two, overseeing all the revenue. And then now in my first executive director role here at the California Symphony. And to wrap this up, I'll say, I always tell everybody what you need to know about the California Symphony is that over the last 5 years that I've been here, we have nearly doubled our audience size and quadrupled our donor base. So all these things that I care about and I'm so passionate about, they're working, is the point I'm trying to make.
So that's a really huge statement to make. If we think about it in the context of not just what the fundraising industry and climate have looked like in the last 5 years, but just overall the general market trends, to have any organization, any company that can say, we doubled our audience and we quadrupled our donor, you know, or our revenue stream, essentially. Unpack that a little bit for me.
You know, everything we've talked about, you and I offline, is all about, you know, retention. And that for us has been a huge building block. This gets to some of the internal things I care about a lot. So we'll talk about that, I know, later. But, everything about having a path and a user journey from that first interaction with us as a first-time attendee all the way through how do we build that relationship to inviting them to return, to become a season ticket holder, and eventually to become a donor. And the nationwide statistic for symphony orchestras is that 90% of first-time attendees never come back for a second visit.
Wow.
90% of first-time attendees never come back for a second visit. And again, that gets into all these reasons why people probably know, like, it can be really intimidating. It can be kind of boring. It can be off-putting. And I'll be the first to admit that, yeah, a lot of that is true about symphony orchestras. And so, we'll talk all about retention in the long haul model. I know we're going to get to that. But the other thing I will say, you know, that has been a part of this success is we have done a lot of work with just, you know, going to our users, UX research, people who we want to be attending the symphony, and asking them about their experience. And lo and behold, we learned all these things like, wow, your website reads like inside baseball. You use so much technical language and jargon. I don't know what to wear when I go. I don't know when to clap and when to applaud. And this was all work we did almost 3 years ago now. But suffice it to say, by actually listening to users and what their experience is, and acting on that feedback and making these changes. So now we do all these things, you know, clap when you like what you hear, bring your drinks to your seats. You know, we have a whole FAQ user guide online. We've like removed all the technical jargon and vernacular. Anyways, I could go on and on, but all this is to say you act on the feedback you hear and then growth follows. That's what we've done. So this is, you know, condensing a lot of work into a very short summary, but, and we always say now, we talk about coming to the orchestra and we use words like we want it to be fun and entertaining. And a lot of orchestras don't use those words to describe themselves.
But for sure not. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then the last thing I'll say to wrap all this up is through our research and the projects I was just describing, we learned that the music is not the problem. And that's a really big differentiator for California Symphony and our approach from other orchestras. And that so many orchestras think, oh, there's something wrong with the music. We need to perform, you know, less Beethoven and instead do more like Harry Potter in concert. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, those concerts sell out. I mean, believe me, they're amazing. They see the movie on the big screen with the orchestra perform it live. But what orchestras see are that those people then don't come back to anything else. And so they're really scratching their heads. And so what we've done is said, no, 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 no. All that like showcases the breadth of what a symphony can perform. Like, yes, we can like totally rock Harry Potter in concert, but also perform a Beethoven symphony very well at a world-class level. And all of that is good. And all of that shows, again, the breadth of what we can do. It's everything else tangential to the experience that is really, really what's keeping people away, not the product, you know? So anyways, I could go on.
Really,
I know this is not an arts podcast.
It is really interesting. I mean, you know, the core thing that I think any of our listeners can take away, and you said it, you know, when you listen to the input from your you know, supporter group, from your from your attendees, and you apply the learnings and do what they've asked, the revenue follows, right? And I think that that's such a challenge for so many. I mean, how many organizations conduct a donor survey or an audience survey? They get the feedback and then they go, oh, it's not what we thought. And it goes and sits on a shelf for 3 years until somebody new comes in and says, hey, we need a survey. And then you sort of cycle again and again, right? And I have a bunch of other questions I want to get to, but this is just leading me to this question. Talk about the discipline required to take those learnings, to understand them organizationally, and then operationalize it.
Discipline is the right word. It takes a ton of discipline. And, you know, it's really hard to hear feedback that hurts. I mean, that is stating the obvious, but it's really hard. And our commitment when we were going through, you know, these focus groups and doing this UX research was we will listen only and we will not jump to defense. And that was an exercise that was so difficult. And, you know, as we're hearing feedback from people, you know, there's so many moments where the tape is playing in my head. Oh, we can't do this because of the CRM limitation. Or we can't do this because, oh my God, who on staff is going to take that on? And instead I just had to say, Aubrey, shut that down. You are at a crossroads. You can either listen to what you're hearing and act on it and have the discipline to do that. Or you can be just what you described, another person who just like takes the data and sets it on a shelf and puts my head in the sand. And I thought, this industry is at such a crux. You know, every nonprofit I think is fragile to a degree. And I think that the arts and performing arts organization and symphony orchestras definitely are very fragile. And I thought, putting my head in the sand just feels more unpalatable than doing the hard work to act on the feedback. And so being disciplined has just become a real part of my DNA. And then to the other part of your question of how do you then implement this into company culture? Well, for us, it meant a few things. You know, some things are big, some things are small. On a big scale, we eventually restructured the staff in order to better deal with some of this work and to implement the long haul model and all this retention work that I know we'll talk about. On a smaller level, it's also about taking baby steps. I'm a really big fan of iterative design. And my staff knows, and it's our culture that, you know, you test something and you try it on a small scale. And then when you see results on a small scale, then you sort of feel a little empowered to either put more money behind it or roll it out on a bigger scale or, you know, whatever that looks like. And so some things just start really small, test, measure, see what's working. And then you can say, okay, no, now we're going to do this in a big way. So I guess that learning culture, iterative design approach is really important. And then from there, that scales up or down into, you know, big decisions versus a lot of little ones that really add up.
Cool. Thank you. So I am super excited about the fact that not just that we're having this conversation, but that you contributed what I think might be one of the most important chapters to my most recent book, The 101 Biggest Mistakes Nonprofits Make and How to Avoid Them. And in it, you talk about the long haul model. Tell me how you got to a place where, how did you come up with it? How did you even think that it might be applicable? And what were the risks that you faced as you started to bring this to market?
These are great questions. The long haul model, to summarize for everybody, is it's all about retention. That is like the shortest concisest summary of what this is. And I think all of us talk about we need to focus on retention. I mean, we know our biggest prospects for a donor is to renew a previous donor. Like, we all know that, right? Then you look at an arts organization, and this is another case where maybe it's helpful if I say sort of what normally happens and then what the model does to sort of tackle the problems that come from that. And then I'll get into the challenges that you asked about. So normally, typically, in air quotes, a symphony orchestra, any performing arts organization, really, what happens is you go, you buy a ticket, you go to your first performance, and then it's sort of this like bombardment that happens from the organization. And I'm sure many of you listening have probably experienced this. The next thing you know, you're getting the telefunding call. Hey, you want to donate? You're getting the season brochure in the mail. Hey, you want to buy season tickets? You're starting to see digital ads all over the internet. Come to the next concert. I don't know, the next annual fund appeals in your mailbox. I mean, you name it. It's just totally this like deluge of messages that then come from that organization. And as I mentioned, I now have almost 15 years experience in this field. And I just witnessed this happening at all these organizations. And as my own seniority has increased and career developed, I've started, as I could, rolling out some of these retention tactics at all of those previous jobs, just in different, you know, different sort of areas of influence that I had. And then when I came to the California Symphony, I said, now I get to put it all together. And so I created this model. I call it the long haul model because it's not about the short-term sale. So everything I just described, the deluge of solicitations, is really about the short-term sale. How do we get you to become a season ticket buyer now? How do we get you, like, who cares what if you renew next season or not? We'll deal with that problem later. You know, how can we get you to donate now? Because we need the money in our annual fund now. And those are real problems. I mean, real feelings that we have and real challenges we have at nonprofits. And so what we have said in creating the long haul model is there is going to be one next step only. No matter who you are, if you are a first-time attendee, as I said earlier, 90% don't come back. That means 10% do. At the California Symphony, we've gotten that to 30% retention. So, and it's because we're not soliciting them for all those other things. We're saying the only thing we invite you to do is to come back again to another performance. Once you've come to a couple performances, then we start rolling out the offer for season tickets. And sure enough, we've seen our subscriber base grow. Then there's another big sort of benchmark in the performing arts industry. First year subscribers, season ticket holders, their renewal rate nationwide is about 50%. So that's another sort of like red flag of like only 50% of new season ticket holders are renewing. And we said, well, guess what? They don't get a donation ask either. The only thing we need them to do is to renew that season ticket package. And then all the data shows once you're like a renewing subscriber, second year or higher, then your proclivity to donate goes way up. And so that's what we've done. And so we do not solicit for a donation until somebody is a second year subscriber or longer. And so that usually this is when jaws drop and they're like, whoa, aren't you leaving money on the table? Like, what the heck? And you already heard me say, through all of this discipline, we've doubled the audience, quadrupled the donor base. So by having this restraint and this really diligent focus, we have just grown at every level and opened up that pipeline. So that's the long haul model. That's the summary of it. And I write all about it in the chapter in your book, as you said. And the second part of your questions was what's challenging in that.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of challenges. I'm not going to lie. I think there are two big ones that come to mind. You know, people think the challenge is going to be that in the short term, you are cutting off revenue because some people do donate the second they get that telefunding call. And some people do buy season tickets in the case of an arts organization when they get the brochure in the mail. And I have worked with enough arts organizations on this approach now that I say, run the numbers. How much money do you actually get from brand new donors who give it these low level annual fund amounts? Because these are not big donors that come in this way. Right. You know, they come in usually at very small amounts. Run the numbers. How much money do you actually get in a given year from brand new ticket buyers who then converted to a donor that same year? It is never more than like 2% of the entire operating budget. And so when you look at it that way, it's like, oh, it's just not that big of a revenue stream. And it's sort of all in our heads that we're somehow like cutting off this big source of revenue. We're not. By having the restraint in the short term, we're opening up the pipeline in the long term. So that's the challenge number one, is just like feeling like you might be cutting off a revenue stream in the short term. And I always counter with, you also have an expense savings by doing it this way. You're not, all of your mailing lists aren't 30,000 people because you're hitting every single person in your dang database who ever breathed, you know. Instead, you're being really focused on who is actually a qualified prospect for this mailing, and that saves you money. And you have higher response rates, so your ROI becomes a lot higher. So there's that. And then through all this that I'm saying, I think I touched on the second challenge, which is just to have the discipline internally. Yeah. And I've been there where it's, you know, it's the end of the fiscal year and you're running that fiscal year end campaign because it's your last chance to balance the budget for the year. And I've been there where I'm pulling the mailing list and I think, oh, if I just add these other people, that my mailing list will grow. And I think that means my prospects are higher. And
right.
You and I know the reality is just that adding unqualified leads doesn't make you more money. It just adds more unqualified leads.
It does.
So anyways, but again, like I said, I've been there where you just feel it internally, this anxiety of like, gotta make the revenue goal. And it's this intense pressure that we all face at all nonprofits, regardless of sort of our corner of the sector.
Yeah.
Short-term pressure is so real.
So I'm curious to know, because I think everybody who's listening is going to think the same thing. How the heck did she convince her board to try this, right? Talk to us about that.
Okay, so there's a couple things. I always say, you know, I was brought in for a financial turnaround and brought into a crisis situation.
Okay.
And I always say the silver lining of a crisis is that there is more of an appetite for change. And so that allows you to leverage that because in this case, the board knew so much so that the old way was not working, that they were desperate for something different. And I was able to say, as I was interviewing for the job, look, if you guys want me, I'm going to do some things differently. And I have some ideas. Are you ready for it? And so I made them give me the verbal blank check to say, yep, do whatever you want, Aubrey. And I said, okay, you got it. So, you know, that's one answer is an organization in crisis may have more of an appetite for change. The other answer for the boards that aren't in crisis and the boards that are much more set in their ways, which is, you know, a real hefty percentage of our boards, I imagine, is I always use the data. It has served me so well in my career to, whenever I'm pitching an idea, to take my subjective opinion out of it and start looking at the data. So that's when it comes in handy to run those numbers. How much money actually is attached to these like desperate solicitations to people who shouldn't be solicited yet? At an arts organization, that's our single ticket buyers. At another nonprofit, I'm sure there's some segment of people that would qualify as probably soliciting too soon.
Sure.
You know, so like, what is the revenue attached to that? Running those numbers and saying, oh, right, it's not that much money. Being able to present that. And then being able to say, but these are the steps we're going to take with this group to get them to be more qualified leads. And then we're going to solicit them. What do you think about that? Does that sound strategic to you? And then suddenly the board says, yes, I get it. I get that there's a plan and that there's a long-term plan. And that has really helped me a lot as I've worked with other boards that weren't in the same position of this crisis feeling, is to be able to say, this isn't about leaving money on the table. No, 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 no. This is about making way, way, way more over the long term.
That's good stuff. So on that topic, how long were the fingers crossed while you waited to see, okay, is this model actually going to pay out for us? Right.
Right. So for us, we started making money in year one. Again, the organization was such in crisis that I think just instilling a lot of these good, solid practices really started generating money right away. And the expense savings that went along with it. Those two things for us in year one, in this job, I balanced the budget and the organization had been about a decade of deficit budgets before that. So year one, we started seeing results. I don't know if that's the case everywhere. I think at a really healthy, robust nonprofit, there might have to be a year one pause, but by year two, we had already almost doubled the donor base. And I forget the size of the audience that grew, but by year two, I remember being able to build in risk capital to our budget.
Okay.
Like risk capital is a word we like never, ever, ever use when talking about building our budgets, right?
No one knows what that is.
Yes. That's right. Nobody knows. So yeah. So by year two, we were building in experiments that we wanted to take on because suddenly we had a little bit extra in the coffers to allow for that. I mean, what like a mind-blowing game changer is that?
Yeah,
so sure. It happens pretty quickly is the answer to your question.
Well, and when you think about, you know, the typical time that a nonprofit has to wait for a new donor they acquired to pay back and to start to generate net, mm-hmm. It's at 18 to 24 months right now anyway. So, you know, assuming that you might need a 2-year time horizon for a turnaround like this, it's not any different than what you're, you know, risking when you invest in new donor acquisition. So it makes a lot of sense.
That's really interesting to hear you say that. Yeah.
I'm curious, as I'm hearing you talk about this and recognizing that you're an executive director, I wonder how you will respond to a hypothesis. I suspect that you are better at your job because you came from, you had development experience before you came into the executive leadership role. React to that for me. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, every executive director, we know it's part of our jobs to be involved in the fundraising. And I think it's so interesting that so often it happens that executive directors are hired without a lot of fundraising experience. And this happens in the arts too. They want somebody who has operations experience or like this sort of like corporate, like COO to CEO transition. And I always think that's so, I just scratch my head over it. It's so interesting. I'm like, why is this happening? And yet it's in every CEO job description for a nonprofit that you are responsible for a lot of fundraising. And of course we are. We're public face. We're meeting with these big donors. So yes, absolutely. My previous fundraising experience matters. And I brought that to this job and it has made me better at this job. Absolutely. Awesome.
Talk to us about, as an executive director, you know, what role, what space do you occupy when it comes to the overall philanthropy efforts of your organization?
For me, we are a smaller staff. I don't know what the typical size is of the audience listening to this, but we have 4 full-time staff members. Okay. And then of course it's this giant orchestra, you know, but and contractors as well, but full-time just 4 of us. And some of those people are on the marketing side and the ticket sales and all of that. So for me, I'm very involved. I personally do all the major gifts. And that goes right back to your previous question of, you know, setting up the executive director for success. We know that the executive director probably should always be involved in major gifts. And at least a lot of those major donors expect that. And so for me, I just said, all right, if we're dividing up this, you know, all the labor between 4 people, that's going to be on my plate. And so including all the, you know, moves management plans and cultivation plans and all of that, I do all of that. When I'm not as zoomed in and hands-on, of course I'm involved with the strategy. So strategy for lower level donors, because that's the pipeline that feeds into my major giving. And I'm always involved in, you know, to the level of what story are we telling in our next appeal letter? What education program are we highlighting? And what's the stat that we can compare or can pair with a story, you know, because all the research shows a stat plus a story about an individual affected by your program and services, that equals fundraising success, you know. So I'm always looking at that, trying to be involved in a strategic level about that, and always sensitive as well to the language we're using. I know that there's a lot in the book about donor-centric language versus organization-centric, and that's a big pet peeve as well when it's give to us and support us and all this. Like, I just go nuts in a bad way over all that, and I just want language that talks about you, the donor, and the impact you're making. And anyway, so I try to be I mean, my staff is very good about this too. I have an excellent staff, but I try to be just one more person, just sort of like proofing all those kind of materials and making sure that that voice we're using across everything we do, whether that's website or direct mail appeal or a brochure or the program book or whatever, trying to make sure that that voice remains cohesive in that way. So I don't know, I guess that means I'm involved in a lot of levels.
It sounds like you're very involved. Yeah. Which I think is, maybe it's fairly similar in smaller organizations. It's very different from many organizations where you're right. There are a lot of executive directors that come in and say, wait, I thought I had a person for that. Right.
Yeah.
But I do think that organizations are more effective when the folks in the C-suite are actively involved in the fundraising activities. It just makes a lot more sense. Yeah. So you've been in your role for 5 years now. What's been the most fulfilling experience for you in that 5 years?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think seeing just the trend-defying growth. And I mean, you heard me say 90% of first-timers don't come back. Most symphony orchestras, it'll be no surprise to anybody listening to this, I'm sure, that most symphony orchestras are not growing their audience. Most symphony orchestras are not seeing mega increases in the number of donors supporting them. And on one hand, that makes sense. Like, we are up against a lot of other good, you know, nonprofits, and there's just the shift generally in philanthropic giving. And you know more about this than I do, Andrew, I'm sure, about just like the trends of, like, you know, the arts just don't have as much intrinsic value as, you know, clean water.
Right.
So, for example, so, you know, there's a lot of ways where it's really hard to be managing an arts organization and really hard to be raising money. for that work. But to see that we have defied the trends of the industry and have used the other programs we offer. We have amazing education programs that are like working towards social change and combating poverty. And then suddenly we're talking about a social justice message that is sort of competitive, if you will, with other, you know, non-musical philanthropic asks. But anyways, I digress. I say all this to say that the success we've seen has been so fulfilling. And, you know, for somebody who really cares about this part of the nonprofit sector, but the way that I think orchestras can be serving others and can be having an impact in a way that it's just not assumed to normally be having, that is what's fulfilling, I think. And then to see that, yes, all the numbers are behind that and the revenue has followed, as we said. And we're still going 5 years later. It wasn't like, okay, you instilled some best practices and got them out of the ditch. Anybody could have done that because the option was either close the doors or improve. But no, 5 years later, we're still growing and it's still working. So I think all that together is just... is super fulfilling.
I think that's proof that it's legitimate, you know, intentionally and valued strategy. So that makes good sense. So I want to ask you a couple more leadership-esque questions. First one is, you know, when you kind of shared your career trajectory, and I've not asked you this directly, but I suspect you're a fairly young executive. And I think we have a lot of people who are young in their careers that listen to the podcast. Did you wake up one day and say, you know, I want to be an executive director at a symphony organization? I mean, how intentional was that career path for you? When did you know I wanted to lead organizations? Like, talk to us about that.
So age is a number. I say that all the time. I think what is more interesting is definitely the career path part of that question. And for me, I was in high school when I decided this was the job I want.
Very
which, like, nobody ever says that. Nobody wakes up and says, I want to lead a symphony orchestra. So my story is when I was 16 years old, I played an instrument growing up. I grew up in Houston. I played in the Houston Youth Symphony. And when I won the audition when I was in eighth grade, by the time I was a sophomore, I'd been a member of the orchestra for a few years. The organization went through an executive director change. And I remember sitting at the back of the orchestra and they introduced this new person and said, like, a sentence about what that job was and who that was. And for me, that was the light bulb moment that there is a job managing this entire operation. And I could be connected to the arts and very involved in the arts. And I could be a leader in the arts. And I could be doing all of that without having a career playing my instrument, but have a career doing all these other things and managing really the business side of it all. So for me, that was the aha moment. And I've been very deliberate since then. And, you know, I went to college, I got a degree in music performance, but also a degree in business, knowing this is what I wanted to do. And now I have over 15 years working for nonprofits and arts organizations, which equals very good experience. So even though I might be quote unquote young, we all know that there are a lot of other people in the field who don't have 15 years experience.
Absolutely.
They've come in, you know, later in life or through other angles, and that's all okay too. But for me, it's been very deliberate, very focused. I know that's not everybody's story, of course. You know, I just think maybe what's important for younger executives or people aspiring to be executives is to have that focus. I've been so intentional with every job I've taken of how does this help get me to the goal? A job in fundraising and then a job at another arts organization in marketing in my case. And, you know, using all of that to build up so much of the foundations of what we've spoken about today. So hopefully that helps, just the intentionality of it all.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there's, and we don't know each other well yet, but if there's one word that I think really fits as I think about who you are that I've experienced, intentionality really is it. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about, as an executive, as a leader, often it's lonely. Right. Often, you know, you've got to make decisions that nobody else is willing to make or ready to make. How do you recharge when you go through tough situations? And talk to us a little bit about who else inside or outside the industry do you look to, you know, not necessarily as a mentor, but, you know, what do you read? Who do you follow? Those kind of things. How do you gain perspective outside yourself?
Yeah, these are great questions. I look outside the industry, outside the arts industry, outside the nonprofit industry so much. And I'm very nerdy in that way. I read business books like crazy. I am just such a voracious reader and love that kind of stuff. And so we go on vacation and my husband's like, you're seriously reading another business book? And I'm like, I like it, okay? And, you know, just go play your Switch, all right, or whatever. But for me, that fills me up. And I know that maybe is not the answer for everybody, but it's important that I'm not reading arts books. I will say that. Like, it's always about, you know, like, what's happening at innovative Silicon Valley companies, and how is there a way where I can apply that mindset and that mentality to what I'm doing? And I think that sort of mental exercise is what fills me up and recharges me, because it really lifts me out of the day-to-day. And instead, I'm solving this really different problem of, again, goes back to company culture or innovation in a way I haven't thought of before. So to get specific in terms of role models, again, I look a lot outside the industry. I think of people like Patty McCord. She was the first chief talent officer at Netflix. I love her book, Powerful. She talks about so many things that you write about in your chapters in the book, Andrew, in terms of just making sure you get hiring right. And don't waste your time or money on hiring a mediocre person when you can hire an excellent person who's going to be a rock star, and what it takes to invest and attract that talent, and then what to do when that talent is no longer serving your organization, because things do ebb and flow and you have different chapters. And I love just the way she writes about all of that and how it really shaped Netflix becoming the company that it is today. Inside the industry, Deborah Borda, she cracked the glass ceiling for arts administrators. This is a very traditional industry, I'm sure everybody can imagine. And the symphony orchestra world can be a real boys club at all levels of seniority, and definitely in the executive director CEO spot. And Deborah Borda, is the CEO of the New York Philharmonic now, before that, the LA Philharmonic. And she's just a role model, because she, like I said, is the one who broke the glass ceiling. So that's been really important to me.
That's awesome.
So yeah, mostly outside the industry, but got to have some people in the field
And that's a legit one to look up to for sure. Yeah. So two last questions for you. First, let's say that there's another young aspiring executive sitting, listening to this podcast saying, you know, what Aubrey's talked about today, I think I gotta bring that into my organization. What are your top two or three recommendations for how someone can bring this level of change? Like, where do you start?
Yeah, I have this conversation all the time as people reach out and have asked this question, how do I do it? And I think the answer, I think it's twofold. The first part of the answer is use that data. I said already, you know, being data-driven has really helped me so much in my career, because, you know, then it's not subjective opinion. The same way I would use to pitch an idea to a board now is the same way I would pitch ideas to my bosses, you know, when I was more junior at an organization. And it works, because again, you're not debating what somebody's opinion is. You're saying, no, this is what the data shows. And so become that person who is so data driven, because most people aren't. And I think, you know, that there's such a need for more of that in all of the nonprofit sector. And so this now moves into my second part of my advice, which is become that person, like be the expert. And yeah, it takes more time to train yourself on whether it's Google Analytics or whether it's becoming this expert user of your CRM so that you can pull all these kind of crazy complicated reports that other people can't, or export it to Excel and manipulate the numbers, like whatever that looks like. You be that person is what I always say, because nobody else is. And now that I've managed enough people for long enough, I can say definitively that, and my staff knows this very well, I'm not looking for more ideas that I should implement. I don't want somebody to come to me with their great idea. You know what we should do, or you know what you should do. Like, I am not interested in that. What I am interested in is when somebody comes to me and says, I've got this idea, here is sort of the plan I've made, these are the steps I'm thinking through on how to implement it, these are sort of the reports I've run already that supports this idea, that maybe there's something here, if there's a budget attached to that, I just need a few $100 to spend, or you know, whatever it looks like. When they come to me with a plan, then I want to say, fly, like, please, like, how can I support you, you know, because then it's an employee saying, I have an idea and I've taken all the initiative. Can I do it? And I know not every boss is like me and saying yes, but I think a lot are, because that's a way better scenario than, Aubrey, you know what we should do? Like, as if I need to implement somebody else's idea because I have all the extra time in the day. You know, it's just a real big shift. So I say, be data-driven, and then be that person, be the expert, take it upon yourself, take the initiative. And I know that takes more time that you probably don't have. I always give that piece of advice or that caveat. I know it's hard. We're so busy, and we're probably overworked and underpaid and all that, but to figure it out definitely has been a move that has helped me. I'll say it that way.
Awesome. All right. So last question. I don't fly Southwest a lot, but rumor has it that you're featured in their most recent in-flight magazine. Tell us, A, how did it happen? And give us a little bit of insight on the magazine article.
Oh, you're so awesome to bring this up. So the April issue of Southwest Airlines in-flight magazine was this whole entire feature on me and my work at the California Symphony. And it has been just the most amazing piece of press. Their circulation is 6.5 million people. That's how many people fly Southwest in a given month. And of course, not every single one of those people read the magazine in the seat back pocket, but a lot of them do. And so how it came about is they found my blog and said, and started seeing some of the things that we've talked about today, like, wow, you're actually doing things seemingly really different. You've got these results to show for it. We want to talk about that. And that's how it came about. It wasn't like our own like PR person was pitching the story or anything like that. It was really organic and inbound, which is so nice when it happens that way. So I would say it was sort of the culmination of a lot of years of really hard work. And then they found California Symphony and decided to write about it. And the results have been so amazing. I mean, with the circulation like that, it's just people across the country are reaching out now and saying, this is awesome. Inside the arts and outside the arts, saying this is the change that I want to see in arts and culture in America. And so talk about rewarding and fulfilling. It's been insane in the best way.
That's really awesome. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Hey, Aubrey, if anybody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for people to contact you?
Oh gosh, I'm on social media, Aubrey Bergauer, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. You can find me in californiasymphony.org if you can't find me that way because my name's complicated to spell. So so there you go.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for being here today. Thanks for sharing your insight and wisdom with us. Really appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising so that you can change the world. You can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.